Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today's Thursday, the 27th of April, 2006. It's now 8:44 a.m., and Senator French, Senator Guest, myself are available. We're going to, just so everybody knows, we're going to start out looking at 307, and then I'm going to have to leave for a while. Senator Huggins is delayed this morning. He has another bill that he has at Senate Finance, and so if we can maintain the discussion in a quorum, we'll do so. Otherwise, we'll take a short recess, and then we'll come back. So let's get started. Jane, good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning. Chairman Seekins, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jane Alberts, and I am staff to Senator Bundy. We bring SB 307 before you. Again, it is a bill by request of the Labor and Commerce Committee. In essence of time, I think that we are still hoping to hear from Bob Mayer, and I believe Ed Stiffen is still online. We're deliberating a cap issue for collection of rent and capping the amount that a landlord could collect for a late fee. But I think the last time we heard this bill, Bob Mayer was not available, so I'm hoping that he could.
He's available this morning, and
okay.
we'll just ask Mr. Mayer. Mr. Mayer, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Sir, if you'll introduce yourself to the members of the committee, we're eager to hear what you have to say this morning.
Okay. My name is Bob Mayer. I'm with the Alaska Manufactured Housing Association. We've been involved with Senate Bill 307 since its conception. Just to briefly touch on the issues that have come up since your last hearing, the reasoning for the what we're arguing for is a 15% cap on late fees instead of the 10%. The reasoning for that is because rents pay mortgages. It's very simple. And when rents are late, mortgages are late. The 15% figure is basically just a pass-through to the resident based on late fees and penalties applied by banks on late mortgage payments. And pretty much out there in the market right now, it is a 15% figure. Going to a 10% figure would mean a rewriting of thousands of rental agreements, pretty much. Late fees are meant to sting, but not kill. An example in our industry here, mobile home parks in Anchorage, the basic rent's about $350. It swings from about $325 to $380. I haven't hit $400 yet, with basically a $50 late fee. That comes out to basically a 15% of the rent amount. I know in apartments it is basically the same. And again, this is just a reflection of what's going on out there. If you are late with your mortgage payment, you not only face a late fee, but you face penalties. So I think that capping it at 15% is realistic, as that's where it sits right now. And I'd like to thank you for your time. Do you have any questions?
Questions for Mr. Mayer. Senator Guest.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Do we at the state level, and maybe this is a question for you or for Jane, do we at the state level cap any other fees or regulate other fees, or do we normally leave that to a local level or a regulatory body in terms of banking and other things? Does anyone know?
Through the chair, Senator Guest, I think in my notes here, I'm thinking that that question was answered last meeting, that there we don't seem to know of anything in statute that does limit that, and I think that is what Ed Sniffen said last time as well, but I think maybe Ed can reconfirm that.
Okay. Ed, are you with us this morning?
I am, Senator Seekins. Thank you.
Yeah, could you introduce yourself for the record and address that question, please?
Yes, I can. My name is Ed Sniffen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law in Anchorage. And, Senator Guest, through the chair, that is a good question, and in a couple of different industries, there are caps on late fees. An example I can think of off the top of my head is in the payday loan context. If you are a payday lender, we have a fairly extensive regulation that our Division of Banking enforces that caps the amount of fee you can impose on a lender if they default on a loan. There are also caps, I think, under our banking laws for
penalty is if you write a non-sufficient funds check, and I think that cap is somewhere around $25. So we do have some legislative caps on late fees and penalties in some industries, but I don't think it's a very widespread practice.
Questions?
No.
The questions for Mr. Sniffen or Mr. Mayor? Senator French, you look like you're pondering this.
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'll just share my thoughts with Mr. Mayor as well as the rest of the folks who are listening. The little bit of checking I've done into this suggests to me that a late payment, for example, on my home mortgage is well under 5% of the total payment that I owe each month to the bank. And so I've been sort of contemplating whether 10% late fee on a rental is fair. My own practice is that the apartments I rent for $750 to $900 a month, we charge a $50 late fee. If your rent is paid past the fifth, we try not to impose those in the first place because sometimes people are late. But once in a while, you have to do it just to, you know, make a point that my mortgage payment's due on time, as Mr. Mayor points out, and your rent's due on time. But 15%, you know, I've been struggling with whether 10% is really not a little bit too high. 10% of a $900 a month rent would be $90 late fee, which for a person who's working for a living is a big chunk of money. And so I'd be reluctant to raise it any more beyond 10, and I've been thinking about lowering it, but certainly I'm not going to go for my own views, I'm not going to go above 10%.
Okay. I, Mr. Mayor, you're pretty certain on that late fee of 15% on a mortgage payment to a bank?
On a mortgage payment, there's penalties, and there's not really a late fee, but there's penalties. Okay, and when you add in the penalties, that's where it starts kicking in. I mean, I'm sure Ed, I'm looking at Ed here, the mortgage market has changed greatly since we were all 20 years ago with, you know, it's a lot of teaser stuff out there going on, and then they get you on the other end of the contract. I've called around and pretty much, I have done a quick survey of those who've been involved with this, and that's what they feel, 15%. Of course, I'd leave that up to the committee, or I'd even argue why even cap it at this time. Well, I mean, historically, we've never had a set percentage on what a late fee can be in the state of Alaska, and it's never really appeared to be a problem. You know, perhaps I would suggest if the committee might just go back to the original language of SB 307 and just, again, let the market dictate it and let the judges dictated. Again, historically, before the Landlord-Tenant Act, this was not seen as a problem. After the Landlord-Tenant Act, this was not seen as a problem, and I don't know. With you.
Senator Guess?
Gene, could a local government, if this language went in or didn't go in, but could a local government regulate? It almost seems like it's a local issue more than a state issue, but maybe I'm wrong.
Through the chair, Senator Guess, I'm assuming that Ed can answer that question, but it would seem like the Landlord-Tenant Act is a statewide act. But Ed, can you help us out here?
Ed, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. Thank you, through the chair, Senator Guess. Yeah, I think Jane is mostly correct in that the Landlord-Tenant Act would supersede any inconsistent local regulation of the rental market, but I think the local municipalities would be free to regulate in those areas that are not addressed by the Landlord-Tenant Act, so long as those regulations weren't inconsistent with the Act. So I think there's some open question about that, but it's certainly not clear, but I think there's room for them to do some regulation, but it would be very limited.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Senator Guest.
Chair, if I could change topics. Gene, were we able to work out some agreement on whether or not late fees could be used for evictions or not? I mean, that's in our first hearing, that was where most of the discussion went. And I don't know if there's a creative way to say that, you know, if the late fees are more than the month's rent, then it can go to, you know, eviction, but you're not going to kick someone out on a $50 late fee.
Through the chair, Senator Guess, I think that there's probably not a simple way to do that as SB 307 stands. A person could be evicted for not paying the late fee under this language. However, as the testimony has been historically, that just rarely happens because it's just frankly too much to do for landlords to go through on a regular basis, and it's cost prohibitive. But I think in the language as it is in SB 307, that could happen. And I think that Ed Sniffen had spoken of another option that we had, was actually rewriting some of the statute, but it would be a lengthy process, and perhaps be able to get that all incorporated, where we could have a single notice, but also make it a little less onerous on the tenant in terms of being able to being evicted.
I would agree with you, never being in a landlord situation, but having a lot of them in my district, that it probably would be too onerous to do it on a mass basis. I guess I'm worried about the individual basis more than anything. But yeah, thank you for reminding me of the previous comments.
I have no problem if we're going to allow someone to be evicted because they haven't paid a late fee, to cap the late fee to a reasonable amount, legislatively, rather than leaving it to judicial discretion. You know, and that's, I think, pretty common. I know we're, in my industry, we're very regulated as to what's reasonable and what's not reasonable, and I've never seen a 15% late fee. I'm a landlord, and I'm also, in a corporate capacity, a tenant, and I haven't seen that kind of late fee. But I'm not dealing in home mortgages. I'm dealing in commercial property. And I've never really looked at my home mortgage to see what my late fee might be if I was late. I don't even make the payment. My wife does, so I don't know when it's due. If I was left to myself, it probably would be late. So I think this bill has some concerns as far as I'm concerned. I'm a little nervous with it. I don't mind having a single notice. Mm-hmm. There's not a problem with that in my mind. I don't want to make the process any more difficult for either party, I guess. I don't want to provide ammunition for someone who's a deadbeat just to skate on the landlord. But I also understand that there are times in the rental industry where hard times can get to someone, and I don't expect that the landlord should become the welfare office on that. But at the same time, the procedures need to be fair, I think, and if we're just going to leave it to the contract and we're just going to leave it to the open judicial process, I think we may be at that point not exercising our legislative authority and responsibility. And in light of the Landlord Tenant Protection Act, and I think that probably does need to have some look at it, but it shouldn't be from me because I'm not a great landlord-tenant person. So I'm trying to find a balance here. Ed, do you have any further comments on what we're looking at so far in this CS?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Seekins. If we want to go back to why we're even talking about a cap at this point, and I think Senator Guest raised some good comments earlier, and that was, do we want to allow landlords to evict tenants for failing to pay a late fee? Because what SB 307 does, it combines the late fee with the rent for purposes of eviction and allows that to be done on a 7-day notice.
Can I excuse you a minute, Ed? I have to run upstairs. I got a bill in Senate Finance, and then we're going to recess until 20 after the hour. I apologize.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Recess till 20 after. And thank you for the recess. We were fairly close on my predicted time. I had to stop and get a little tea, or we would have made it on time. Let's move back to 307. Any other questions? Are Bob and Ed still on the line?
Yeah, we're both still here.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other questions for Mr. Mayor or Mr. Sniffen? And Ed, I interrupted you, so if you want to continue your thoughts, I'd appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Chairman Deakins. I'll wrap up very briefly. I just wanted to mention the reason, and the only reason we're talking about a cap on late fees is because we got to a point in this bill where we were discussing a way to treat tenants under SB 307 fairly, and in responding to some of Senator Getz's questions, whether or not we really wanted to use the failure to pay late fees as grounds for an eviction. And one of the compromises we thought of was perhaps capping the late fee, so if there was going to be some kind of an eviction based on a late fee non-payment, it would be at least reasonable. So if we follow up on Senator French's question about whether 10% is reasonable, is 5% reasonable, I know Mr. Mayor has advocated for 15%. That's a call the legislature needs to think about if you want to go that way. There is certainly another way to fix some of the problems we've talked about. I know Mr. Mayor and I have been discussing this on these breaks too, and that would be to revisit the statute and see if there is a way to come up with a better statutory design that allows landlords to issue a single notice to include the fees that are owed by the tenants, and do it in a way that provides landlords protection and tenants protection. But that is an exercise that would be time-consuming, and I don't know it's something we could do with this bill. So anyway, with that, I'm happy to answer any questions the committee has. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Sniffen? Senator French.
Not for Mr. Sniffen, but just to make sure, did we get a CS that has the late fee cap in it?
I think it caps it on G, golf.
Okay, I guess I'm just
page 3, lines 24 and 25.
I'm missing a copy of that. I think
basically says that a rental agreement cannot contain terms that if they're late, that the late fee exceeds 10%.
I see. I've seen it before. I just suddenly didn't see it in front of me. And / golf, the one we're working on, does this still allow for an eviction on a late fee? Is that what we're?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Did you want to address that anywhere? Are there any amendments to the bill, any proposed amendments to the bill?
Well, you know, conceptually, Mr. Chairman, here's what I would propose as a way maybe to try to make do what we can in the time that's allotted to us. I would propose, if you're going to allow an eviction on a late fee, to push it back to 10 days. That at least has given the tenant 3 more days to make right on his or her obligation to pay rent. And I would propose streamlining the process so there's one notice and one hearing, and if a judge would conduct sort of a dual inquiry: one, yes or no, have you paid the rent? Two, is or is not the failure to pay the late fee a material breach of the lease? And that could be done in one hearing, done with one notice, done at one time. It's fair to both sides. I don't think it delays it to a burdensome extent for the landlord. And it sort of gains, if you will, in efficiency what you lose in 3 days. So that's the conceptual amendment I'm proposing.
Okay.
And I guess I'd like to hear what Mr. Mayor and Mr. Sniffen think.
Any comments, Mr. Mayor?
Again, the reason for the 7-day notice is because there's 30 days in the month, and by the time you hang, you know, if rent falls due on the 1st, you give a 10-day grace period, a 5 or 10-day grace period. Then on the 11th or 12th, you hang your 7-day notice. At the end of those 7 days, you can send that notice into your attorney to file with the clerk of the court. By the time that happens, your attorney takes it in to the clerk of the court. The clerk of the court sets a date, which is usually 7 to 10 days out for district court. Then the judge hears the case. If the process server has found the tenant and been able to serve them, then the judge will hear the case, enter his opinion, and give the tenant time to move out, usually 48 hours or 72 hours. And sometimes this procedure takes, you're into the next month by the time this whole procedure is through, and I think that's the reason for 7 days, and I'd like to hear his comments on that, if I could.
Mr. Sniffen?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator French. I think the single 10-day concept is actually a good one, and I don't think fundamentally there is really that big of a difference between 7 and 10 days, even going through the scenario that Mr. Mayor suggests. I just can't envision that 3 days is going to be a deal breaker for a lot of these things. But the single notice concept is something we have actually thought about. The only concern we'd have to address in the notice is to make sure tenants weren't confused by what the notice says. Because if you have a single notice that says, pay your rent or we can kick you out, oh, and by the way, you also have to pay this late fee, and we may or may not be able to kick you out depending on whether the late fee is a material breach of the contract. The notice can be a little complicated, but I think there's a way to work around that, and streamline the process in that regard is certainly a good idea. But we would we certainly wouldn't have an objection to a single 10-day notice.
Okay, other questions? Where would you propose this amendment, Senator French?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's that kind of falls back into the heading of I'd need a little time to work that out.
All right. Okay. There's a conceptual amendment that's been proposed by Senator French to have the notice to be a 10-day notice in lieu of a 7-day notice. Is there a discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, is there objection to the amendment?
I guess I would want to see it.
We'd like to see it?
In writing, just so we know what it does and that it can be written that way.
We'll do that. We'll ask that that Senator French prepare for us an amendment where we would insert that in the bill, and we'll hold the bill until we see that in writing. Okay. With that, thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
I think we've made some progress here today. I'm sorry that it was taking so long for us to do so. And thank you, Mr. Sniffen and Mr. Mayor, for being with us this morning.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, let's move. Let's take a brief at ease. And we're back on the record, and now we're looking at 316. And for the record, time constraints, we're going to meet tomorrow morning at 9:30, and we will at that time pick up 307 again, at 414, House Bill 414, and House Bill 190 at 9:30 tomorrow morning, just so that everyone knows. And we're going to try to get 316 out of committee today. Okay? Let's look at 316, and what we've done is we asked the drafter yesterday, and I'll have to apologize because this came in after we started meeting, to conform the language on Section 310 and 435. So I have not yet looked to see if they did that. Larry, have you had a chance to take a look at this CS?
For the record, Larry Ostrovsky, Department of Law. Mr. Chenoweth is an excellent drafter, but I think that the new 430, let me look at this, that 435.2, to accomplish what you'd suggested, probably ought to look like 410.2 with, instead of saying proposed contract and preliminary findings, say something to the effect that make copies of the contract, the commissioner's final finding and determination, and to the extent there were the information not required to be confidential. I think that would be parallel, because that would still protect information that needs to be kept confidential under 300.
So
that would be my suggestion.
Yeah, my suggestion to the drafter was that, in concept, that there's a supporting document that he has to provide at
Point of order, Mr. Chair. Can we just get a line and a page?
Right, that's what I'm going to look at.
Thank you.
I'm trying to locate it myself.
In the bill?
Didn't mean to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Page.
The existing bill. Let's look at, Lima of the existing bill.
I'm on backslash.
Lima or what?
I mean, I'm looking at the original, not the bill. I'm talking about the law. I'm sorry.
Okay.
The law.
And
which section? Law. On 410.2,
I see. Make copies.
He says, make copies of the proposed contract, the commissioner's preliminary findings determination, and to the extent the information is not required to be kept confidential under the supporting financial, technical, and market data. My instructions were that that language be carried forward to the material to 435.2, that it be consistent.
B1 or B2?
Under B2 would be, let's see, B1. Yeah.
I see. So you, I see.
I wanted to say, okay, now what happens is the commissioner provides that information. He goes into public comment. He has to basically update his findings, his final findings, and have whatever new information he's used in developing those findings to support those findings then brought up. So basically, my intent here was to try to get the same language that's in 410.2 transferred over to 435B1 as far as the records and files.
So if I could, Mr. Chairman, B1 under the backslash INDI that we're looking at would read, submit to the legislature the commissioner's final findings and determination, and, comma, to the extent the information is not required to be kept confidential under AS 4382.310, the supporting financial, technical, and market data, including work papers and analysis, et cetera, as it stands in 410.2.
And basically, the drafter included all those documents that were supposed to, that are required to be confidential.
Welcome to drafting.
So it looks like I got 180-degree different there.
Struck a blow for public information that's a little too broad.
Which I don't object to, you know, the supporting information other than proprietary information that would, actually, we could get into places where we were violating SEC rules by requiring that to be made public. So this probably does not meet the intent under, so, but let's start by having a working document that we can work with and...
Do you want to start with...
I'm not sure I want to start with this.
Okay.
So we're going to maintain where we are with the current working document without objection. What did you have there, Senator French, Senator Guest, some conforming language that you were suggesting?
I'll go...
We're on version Yankee.
Why dot...
We're on Yankee, yes.
I'll explain mine for the consideration of the committee. It's just something we talked about, so I kind of just sat down yesterday and requested it. Y.2.
Y.2, just a moment. Let me see. Okay.
And all I did was look at the language that was in 400A1 and the language that was in 400A3. One's about the preliminary findings, one's about the final findings, and what I asked, although I just got it about the same time we got the CS, was that we make those the same. And so the preliminary findings and determination that the proposed contract terms are in the long-term fiscal interest of the state and meet the requirements and purposes of this chapter. And then if you go to page 2 of the amendment, make final findings and determination that the proposed contract and any proposed amendments prepared under 2 of this section meet the long-term fiscal interest of the state and the requirements and purposes of this chapter. We had talked, Mr. Chair, when we were going through that, you know, that fiscal interest is implied in both of them, and it just seemed like there was an inconsistency in the statute. So this was my attempt for the committee just to bring those things in line, so the preliminary and the final findings had the same language.
Okay. And I see what you're doing. I think we put a hurdle there that will be a policy call as to whether that's what we want to do or not. If we take a look at page 1 on lines 11 and 12, where we say now that the preliminary findings have to be that the contract terms and meet the requirements and purposes of the chapter. I don't think that the contract can be given to us or can be provided to us as a legislature or even to the public in with any proposed amendments that we may want to consider in the contract. I think we've put an impasse there to where we, under the current law, it can't be made public unless it absolutely meets, now, if we adopt this, absolutely meets the requirements of the chapter.
Okay.
And so it could not be forwarded as a proposed contract, but that in order for this to meet the stipulations of the law, these changes would have to be made in the law, or amendments to the law. So I think it may have put a roadblock there that I don't think you intended.
I guess I didn't see a lot difference on the purposes of this chapter and meets the requirements. I was just trying to make both of them parallel.
I understand what you're trying to do, and I'm asking.
Because I think you're going to have the same problem with the current purposes section.
I understand. What do you think, Larry?
If the chair would just give me one moment.
Sure.
So this would be, I'm sorry, I'm having trouble. This is to version Y?
It's version Y, too.
But it would add 2 new sections, so you really need to look at the law.
At the current law.
Right.
For example, Mr. Chair, one of the purposes under the Stranded Gas Act is new investment without significantly altering the tax and royalty methodologies and the rates on existing oil and gas infrastructure and production. So even under the current language, if that's a purpose of, I think think you're going to run into the same.
We're going to run into some problems, and I'm trying to make sure there that what we get is a finding, a preliminary finding that says this meets the purposes or the overall purpose of the act, but it's going to take these changes in the law to make it comply. Senator Friend?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're all talking about the same problem, which is the mismatch, if you will, between the contract that's being developed and the law as it stands right now. But I guess I would just remind the committee and the folks that are watching that the governor has the authority to release the contract no matter what. I mean, he has the authority inherent in his position. It's, and I've got a letter from an assistant attorney general stating that. So to the extent that there may be a little bit of a chicken and egg problem here, I think that can be overcome.
I just want to make sure we don't get into that business.
Yeah.
I don't have any problem. You know, I would like to see that thing happen is, okay, that here's the act, here's the contract, here's where we believe that it meets the requirements of the act, and these are proposed terms in the contract, and this would require, but in order for it to meet the terms of the act, would require these changes. That's kind of what I'm looking for in the final product.
Of this bill?
Of the when it comes to us. When it comes to the public and it first comes to us.
I think we're all in agreement.
That's
the way it's going to.
Gives it that pathway and says, we just want all the cards on the table. And he says, okay, we don't think that this bill, it doesn't meet the requirements or so it's kind of like how it meets the requirements, or if it does, or if it doesn't, tell us how it doesn't. That's what I'm after.
I think to have done it perfectly, you would have had to have amended the Stranded Gas Act already. That would have been the cleanest thing, to have submitted a series of amendments at the beginning of this session. They could have been acted on and voted on, and then you can bring it. But I'm just you know, walking the public and I think our own minds through how the process would have been the most orderly,
sure,
the most sort of technically legal.
Yeah,
but that's not where we find ourselves.
And I guess I understand that the purposes are there, and I guess if it doesn't meet the purposes of the act, or if it doesn't meet the requirements of the act, I want to know why this proposed contract doesn't, and what any solutions to that might be, so that then the we and the public can give input as to how that should line up, and what we think it should do, and then come back to us again with the, after considering that public input, after considering that municipal group, after considering comments that come from members of the legislature, they come back to us and say, okay, we've revised this contract and you've revised the law, so now we believe that it lines up with the law and the contract this way, but it's up to you to make the final decision as to whether or not you believe it does. And that's kind of the process I envision, is that how you see it?
Connie's out there.
We need at ease, please.
At ease. Just a short recess. Back on the record, I knew immediately what that recess was for. I just wanted all to be out in the light of day, and I think you are right, Senator, that it's going to be tricky. It's going to be tricky because, but what I do want, I think this first opening gambit has to be with the contract. Here's the contract that we're proposing.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how it meets the law. Here's where it needs some changes in the law. What do you think? Give us your comment, Senator French.
Just as to the amendment, I think the degree to which we can impose some regularity and some parallel language, I think is good. I think the same problem will exist either under the existing statute or the amendment as proposed by Senator Guess. I guess it's just a call for the committee to decide what language we think that the governor and the contractor are going to have to overcome when it comes to making preliminary findings. And vis-a-vis the way the contract matches or doesn't match up with the chapter as it's written right now.
Yep. Senator Guest?
So the question may be on the preliminary findings we should have and whether the contract meets the requirements and the purposes of this chapter, and we shouldn't have that on the final findings. We were questioning what that really meant on the final findings. It seems like there's a role, there may be a role on the preliminary findings, given the current timing, as no?
Well, I was
Senator French.
Right. I was starting to think I was agreeing with you. I think you were suggesting that the first, the preliminary findings come with the question of whether it meets it, since there may be some issue about whether or not it does. But with the final finding,
the finals shouldn't.
It's got to say that it does. Of course, in our own minds, we know it's going to be as amended, so to speak, as the Strain and Gas Act is amended when the contract finally comes back to us.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
I think
the language that's in 433, which says make final findings and determination as to whether the proposed contract and any proposed amendments prepared, if we were to say on 400A1, determination that the proposed contract terms are in the long-term fiscal interest of the state and whether the proposed contract meet the requirements and purposes of the chapter. If that language were put in where you've done yours, I think, in 400, Gretchen, Senator Guest, I'm sorry, it would meet the requirements of the, would meet what I envision the process to be.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with you. The place that on the preliminary on 400A1, I think where I would disagree is the confusion as to whether in the final findings has caused this committee. I think the confusion it causes in general.
So is there a reason why then we wouldn't just want to leave the language the way it is, that it furthers the purposes of the chapter?
Are we talking preliminary or final?
The preliminary, or whether.
No, I would agree on the preliminary,
okay.
That if we put
let's
as
just,
to whether
let's
the contract.
That. Let's attack that one first. If,
yes.
If your amendment were to be to on A1 to state that make preliminary findings and a determination that proposed contract terms are in the long-term fiscal interests of the state and whether the
contract meets the requirements.
Contract meets the requirements and purposes of this chapter.
That seems to be in line with what's going to be reality.
Okay. So is that, let's approach that.
Has anyone moved this amendment?
Not yet. I'm just approaching.
No, because I was going to get it redrafted
since
we need to get the other
drafting.
One,
okay.
The
we're
work
draft,
we're draft. Redrafted.
We're talking in concept here.
Can I read it as I think
Senator
it
French?
Thank you. On /Y.2, lines 10 through 13 would now read, make preliminary findings and a determination that the proposed contract terms are in the long-term fiscal interests of the state and whether the contract meets the requirements and purposes of this chapter. Is that what we've drafted?
That's how I would envision it.
That's what I wrote it down,
okay.
Yes.
We can approach this as an amendment to Yankee and solve the same problem without having to worry about what Yankee 2. So if we, in concept, go to...
Does Yankee have 400 in it?
No, it doesn't. We have to put it in, don't we?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I can...
All right. Okay. We're going to have a title change, so we'll have to get this... Let's just get it in concept, and then we'll get the final form of it done.
Yeah.
Okay?
I'll get it redrafted.
All right. Now, let's go... Go back to page 2, Senator Guest.
And then page 2, Mr. Chair, I think reads as it is amended. So it puts the long-term fiscal interests in. and it, but it takes out the as to whether. I'm not sure why we would have as to whether in final findings. It confused
We've had two findings. We've always had two findings as our final findings. And...
Well, three.
Again, we've left on one, it is an absolute finding in 430B that the determination finding there is that it, the contract is in the long-term fiscal interest of the state. The other finding and determination is in 410A3, which is as to whether the proposed contract and any proposed amendments meet the requirements and purposes of this chapter. Again, in the past, when that was determined and it was a final determination, it was executed by the administration. They had the authority to execute. Now we've interjected a discretionary further approval on the part of the legislature. What I think we're in danger of, if we're not careful, is saying that until it absolutely lines up between the law and the contract, that the legislature can't consider a proposed contract. Is that what we want to do?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to go back to, well, okay, you can ask a question on that, and then I'd like to go back to 430B because I don't see that as a final finding or determination. It's a commissioner determination that's not an agency decision. And that's just whether or not he hands the contract over to the governor. So I don't want to put those in the same.
Let me ask Larry.
Yeah, let's settle that up.
Okay. Larry?
Mr. Chairman, I think that just first with respect to the change in 400, I think that reflects the process we think that's going to happen with amendments. With respect to the change in 430A3, which is version Y, page 2, in my view, the as to whether is preferable language, partly due to the issues of effective date. For example, if the if there's amendments to the Stranded Gas Act and if they don't pass with an immediate effective date, that won't be, if those amendments won't be effective for 90 days. So I'm not sure even the commissioner's final findings and determination would meet the requirements of the act as it exists at that time. But with the language that's currently in law, even in the final finding, which is going to the legislature, of course, the commissioner could say that, for example, I believe that these don't meet the requirements under current law, but meet the requirements as to the law that's been amended. And that's just my only issue with respect to those words, as to whether. Because at the time he signs it, the amendments might not be effective.
That's true, too. Senator Guess?
Yes. It seems as if the final findings shouldn't be wishy-washy. They should be final findings that the contract and the proposed amendments are both in the long-term interest of the state and comply with the act. I mean, the one thing that's, you know, that we haven't really discussed that came up in the legal memo from 393 was, is our authority as a legislature constitutional or not? And if it's not, then all people have is this section. And if you keep the as to whether, what's the what do people actually take to court? I mean, it's a final finding as whether or not it complies with the law, not a final finding on it complying with the law, which seemed to be the purpose of 393. So
no matter what happens on whether it complies with the current law or not, it's still a discretionary effort on the part of the result from the decision made by the legislature when it passes a law. So the law that the legislature passes to authorize the execution of the act supersedes the requirements of the Act. The legislature says, we understand that it does not meet the requirements of the old law, but we're going to authorize it anyhow. And it, therefore, it allows the execution of the contract. So and I understand that, and then the constitutional issue that remains is one of whether or not it's in the long-term fiscal interest of the state. But whether it applies to the Act or not, if it meets the requirements of the Act, isn't a constitutional issue. It's just what the legislature did last. That's what it amounts to.
Well, and this goes around to the conversation we've been having all week. I mean, there's two issues. Then why have the Act? Which I think is kind of the elephant in the room. But the other issue is, you know, at least we've had some in the law review of 393 say, can the legislature even approve this act or not? If someone takes that to court and the court finds no, because of separation of powers, the legislature should not have approved or disproved an act, there is not this recourse in there. And I guess so that's my concern, to make sure that the final findings and determination are kept whole in this bill.
I understand where you're going, but I also understand that there has to be some legislative discretion involved in when can the legislature look at it, and when can the legislature authorize the execution. If the findings are that it complies with the Act in every respect, then why have legislative authorization? What are we there to do?
Mr. Chair, we might find that it complies with the Act, but we might still think that it's not the best deal for the state.
Or
we might think that another deal, the Act isn't specific enough. The complying with are just the here's your guidelines for it. Does it comply or not? Might be in the fiscal interest of the state, but maybe people think that there's a better deal out there. I don't know.
Senator Terrio?
So, Mr. Chairman, have burrowed in on this particular issue, and I'm following the conversation here, but is it your opinion then that this still leaves a snag in the system?
Well, it leaves it open to one possibility that I haven't discussed, and I'm not an attorney, that unless it absolutely applies with the Act, it was improper to forward it to the legislature for consideration.
For the final, not the preliminary.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but if I was going to try to attack a crack somewhere, I would say you guys sent this to the legislature, and you were wrong in doing so because the Act and the findings don't line up, or the Act and the contract don't line up. Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, but we have to also keep in mind that we know, we keep talking about the Act. It's a document that hasn't been written yet. We've got one form in front of us, but we know there's going to be a whole handful of amendments modifying the language. So it really is difficult. In the perfect world, you would have said, if we thought there were changes to the rules, the Act is sort of the rules, you would have made those first, and then you would have decided where the public's right to, you know, challenge and whether you met the rules, and then you would have the contract come out. And I guess if we'd gotten into this discussion 2 months ago, perhaps we would say, well, that's really the process that we need to play out, and we don't have the time now. But so as far as whether it meets the rules as stated in the Act, we're going to be changing those rules. Well, we expect we're going to be changing those rules.
And we could change the rules again in the final consideration.
Well, in discussions with the administration, I've indicated that, you know, it's my personal desire, and I think the desires of the committee, to not have this snag in the system that just stops everything. But we try and preserve the public's right to scrutinize and just place it at the end of the process. And so I'm just wondering, from the debate here, I guess there's a difference of opinion on.
Well, yeah, I was just trying to clarify something I heard from the committee, but it doesn't it doesn't seem like as if it is something that we all agree on. So there are more important things to deal with than.
I think it's important though that that we have everything out there. What my final product would like to I'd like to see is pretty much the way it's in the Act now. I'd like to see those final findings and determination as to whether the proposed contract and any proposed amendments prepared meet the requirements and purposes of this chapter. Now that is a lineup in my opinion, but I think the final finding might be it still doesn't quite meet it, but we're going to forward it for your consideration, and here's where it still doesn't quite meet it.
Which, Mr. Chair, goes to my question of why would the legislature ever consider the amendments to the final to the Stranded Gas Act?
We could say,
why? I mean, if all we're going to do in the final findings is say, do they line up or not? They can tell us that in the preliminary, and we can make a decision. I'm not sure why we would spend our time amending an act if we are just going to have the ability to ignore that act or ignore those amendments.
I guess it's just kind of because we do. It's a sad thing in how the legislature works, but the legislature, no previous legislature binds the current legislature, and we can always amend it. We can always amend however we want to make it fit. I'm just trying not to give people false hope, that's all.
No, and I'm not either, as if we would go through 20-plus amendments to the Stranded Gas Act, we would approve 10 of them, we would get a contract that reflects 20 of them, and I'm not sure why we would waste the public's time on amendments to the Stranded Gas Act if there's not going to be a requirement that the contract meet the act.
Well, let's come back to the second part. But in concept, are we all agreed that on the first part, that under 400,
I mean, I don't think it really matters.
We would use
stated, but
that language on 400. We want to know whether the read that again, Senator French.
On the amendment that I have, backslash Y dot two, lines 10 through 13 or 10 through 12 would read, Commissioner shall make preliminary findings and a determination that the proposed contract terms are in the long-term fiscal interests of the state and whether the contract meets the requirements and purposes of this chapter.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, could you restate that?
I'm on the
be looking at this
Senator Guess has got it written out here, so
okay.
Comment, Larry?
I'm sorry, Senator. As to which?
We're talking about Senator Guess is Y.2.
Yes.
And Senator French, if you'd read that again.
Sure, Y.2, lines 10 through 12. Commissioner shall, one, make preliminary findings and a determination that the proposed contract terms are in the long-term fiscal interests of the state and whether the contract meets the requirements and purposes of this chapter.
As I mentioned before, I think that reflects the fact that the contract and that the commissioner would say if the proposed contract doesn't line up.
Is there any objection to that conceptual amendment? We'll have it drafted up.
Okay.
Second part of Senator Guess's amendment. Let's look at a couple other things. We asked that the language in four 35 B1 435 B1 just indicate that it be the updated supporting information that's required for under 400. And they did it the opposite. So we'll, is there any objection to us just making it the draft, the updated information that would be required with the same confidentiality caveats in 400? Seeing none, we'll get that drafted. I think we do need to look at our intent under 430A3, and I think, Senator Guest, as I look at that, we've got the other two behind us, there's two sections that I think, if we amended it the way you've proposed, there would now be no reason for 430B. Or there would be less reason for 430B. Since 430B addresses the fiscal interests.
430B addresses when the commissioner gives the contract to the governor.
And the long-term fiscal interest.
It doesn't, though, not in the same regard, because it's not a final determination. It's, and maybe either Larry or Hollis needs to correct, but the, if you look under C, the commissioner's final findings and determination under A are final agency decisions. B doesn't, at least to my reading, carry that weight.
In some respects, it doesn't require the making of the of them, but it requires the making of a decision or determination. He has to have a determination. It's inferred. It's not directly in the language, but it's inferred, because until he makes a final long-term fiscal determination, he can't forward the contract. Larry?
We've discussed this a little bit, and I think it is a little ambiguous, but I think that the way I read it, the final findings and determination that the contract meets the requirements purposes of the chapter support in part the conclusion that's in the long-term fiscal interest of the state. If there's a challenge, in the sense of challenges to the conclusion of that, you couldn't reach that conclusion based on the findings and determination. So even though the statute does separate them, I think they are, for all practical purposes, linked.
Is there any reason why we wouldn't take paragraph 3 and at the end of it, after chapter, insert the words, and a final finding and determination that the contract meets the long-term fiscal interest of the state? Just to clarify that one is required there somewhere rather than by inference?
I think one could do that.
If we took A3, shall make final findings and a determination as to whether the proposed contract and any proposed amendments prepared under 2 of this subsection meet the requirements and purposes of this chapter, and a final findings and determination that the contract meets the long-term fiscal interests of the state. That requires the findings to be there, and then it's no longer inferred, but then. So after, then B would be, after considering the material described in A of this section and securing the agreement of the parties to the proposed contract regarding any proposed amendments prepared under 3, and after rather than if, after the commissioner determines that the contract is in the long-term fiscal interest of the state, the commissioner submit the contract to the governor. With would there be any problem with that?
I think that is not a material change.
So I'm just trying to address the issue of making sure that it's referenced here first, Senator Guest.
Oh, yeah. We can reference it either way.
Is there any objection to that conceptual amendment? Any comment?
I can't follow it until I kind of see it.
Once I see it written down, I think I'll be
right.
better able to.
We'll get it.
Yeah.
We'll get it. Okay. Now, the content or the certification or the determination in the findings regarding the requirements and purposes of the chapter. Do you want to amend that, or is that satisfactory?
That's the as to whether.
Yeah.
I guess I lean towards clearer is better, and I'm not sure why a contract would be forwarded if the contract didn't align with the statute. So I guess I would ask the committee to think about that concept on whether or not the as to whether should be in the statute or not.
All right. We'll think about that while we get the other amendments done. Then, Larry?
If I could just, I mentioned this before, I don't mean to be the dead horse, but it does raise some potential timing issues.
Right. I'm a little bit concerned about that, but we'll look at that language.
Yeah, and I guess someone's going to have to walk me through that because I'm not sure why it would. It seems as if we could correct that. That shouldn't be an issue in this. The issue is whether or not the contract is in alignment with the statute.
Right. The timing issue is an effective date issue, and whether right now, with that change, you would say the contract is meets the requirements and purposes of the chapter. If the legislature changed the requirements of the chapter, but that wasn't effective at the time the commissioner submitted the final finding, then even though it was the legislature's intention to change the requirements of the chapter through some amendments, even when the commissioner sent the final finding, it wouldn't necessarily line up.
If the bill were to pass, but the effective date clause mm-hmm. did not pass, it could be a 90-day delay. If the legislation passed, had an immediate effective date, there would be no timing issue. But unless it did have an immediate effective date, there could be a timing issue.
Yes.
Okay. Seems like
okay.
That should be able to be resolved
All right.
somehow.
And that's what you're basically
yes.
saying. Right?
Yes.
Other amendments that are proposed? Senator French?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment that has my name on it and is /Y.1 is brought in response to a couple of concerns. The easiest one to express is this one. It's been my interest, and I believe the interest of the committee, to maintain as fully as possible all the substantive legal rights that the public has to challenge the process, if you will, for lack of a better name, when the time comes for that challenge to happen. And the basic idea is to maintain that sort of legal landmark, that term of art that Mr. Ostrowski has told us that the legal community is comfortable with, and that's the final findings and determination of the Commissioner of Revenue. And so that the central part of the amendment would just simply put that into Section 440, the judicial review portion of the bill that we're considering, and just keep it in there. It's something of a belt and suspenders approach, because we're going to have a challenge to the material that the legislature relied on, but it also keeps that sort of comfortable known legal entity present in the judicial review section. But underneath that is a real concern that I think Senator Terrio started to express the other day, and it's been hitting me kind of like a thunderbolt the last day or so, and that is with respect to the constitutionality of the legislature's authorization of the contract. there is, I think, a real issue with that. There's a real issue as to whether or not that isn't some violation of the separation of powers, whether or not we're not intruding on an executive function. And it may be that there will be a challenge to that very authorization. And it may be that it could occur as we're considering authorizing. More likely, it will come afterwards. And someone could easily come into court and say, that authorization was constitutionally defective. It was inappropriate, it was wrong, it was a violation of the separation of powers. The executive has the authority to execute a contract, and the legislature had no business inserting itself in that process. If that legal argument is made, and if that legal argument is successful, then the belt and suspenders approach that's being advanced here in this amendment would leave in place the final finding and determination of the Commission of Revenue as sort of the last administrative act, and would leave it there as the known sort of legal flag in the process that would, I believe, be the default place where you'd begin your assault or your inquiry into whether or not that finding was adequate, thorough, justified by the record, and so forth. And so I think that this is sort of brought out of an abundance of caution, sort of on two fronts. One, to assure the public that we're not trying to restrict their rights to challenge the contract, just on a facial sort of level. But more substantively, if there is a separation of powers argument, and it is successful, it would keep in place and assure, if you will, our ability to go forward on a contract that we had blessed. Because again, we're not allowing a challenge until after we execute or after we give the governor the authority to execute the contract.
Well, it's a point. I think first of all, we have affirmatively preserved the challenge on a constitutional issue, including if that's going to be the constitutional issue. We've limited the time when it can be brought to 120 days after the contract is executed. The interesting thought there is that if under the normal contract basis that the state would enter into, you could carry the constitutional challenge then all the way back through to the beginning of the Stranded Gas Development Act. I know everything is severable in every law. We know that, but and that is a question. And I think as long as, well, let me think about this. I think that's an interesting point. However, well, it's going to be hard to determine all the possible challenges someone who just wants to destroy the state of Alaska's ability to get their gas to market might come up with.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess, and this is maybe why I was confused with the version of the bill that we got. This is what I thought we had been talking about the whole time, is, you know, at this point when we're 2 weeks away, not taking anyone's legal rights away that they currently have. But dealing with the timing issue. So I guess this was the assumption of the direction that we were going, but I could have misunderstood.
I don't see,
misunderstood.
At first blush, I don't see how this changes what we have, but that's, I mean, we're defining what those findings are.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it was drafted, the findings and determinations relied on by the legislature authorized the execution versus the final findings and determination of the commissioner. Basically, I don't know how it changes what we have. It may change some of the language. I'm not sure that it changes what we already have. But let's do this so that we can take a look at the. I mean, that's an interesting chain of events that you've brought up, Senator French, and maybe we just need to take a look at that. So, are there any other proposed amendments that we would want to look at?
Mr. Chairman, I have had one distributed that is I.1 dated the 27th.
Okay.
That proposes to bump the minimum public comment period from 30 days to 90 days. And it is, you know, I've been encouraging the administration for months now that they err on the side of more time. We know that when the contract gets, you know, finally distributed, not only are we trying to figure out its impact, but there are other companies that have not been part of the negotiations that are also trying to figure out the impact to their companies and how they're going to be able to play in the game if the contract goes forward. And I'll note, and with the caveat that this is not a perfect comparison, but in the filings with the FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, with regards to how long an open season should be for companies to figure out, you know, whether they want to nominate for capacity, the administration said, given the size and cost and complexity of this project and the substantial disclosure that will come about in the open season notice, potential bidders will need substantial time to evaluate the information and prepare responsible and responsive bids. Even a period of 120 days may challenge the ability of smaller or non-traditional bidders to participate. And so again, that's specifically on open season where companies are actually having to decide whether to bid for capacity. So I mean, their company, their corporation would be on the line then if they actually bid for that capacity. So that was a suggestion that even 120 days might challenge them. It seems that, you know, the current language is minimum 30 days. Everybody expects it to be longer than 30 days. We expect that the administration to even walk us through the contract with daily meetings will take, you know, 10 days, maybe 2 weeks even. So there's unease with the way we're making the change with regard to the public's right to appeal, and we're trying to preserve that appeal right, just move it to the end of the process. It seems like we can give some extra comfort too if we really move the minimum public comment period to what we expect is likely and what we expect or what we feel is reasonable. And I believe that, you know, from the people that I've talked to, companies and legislators, they expect that it's something beyond 30 days.
So. Questions?
Okay. Well, I'd go as far as 120 days, as long as they get too far into moose season.
Or just past it.
Yeah. So 120 days work for me. So.
Or moose season.
Yeah.
Whichever moose season comes first.
Is important in there. Yes. What we're going to do is set the bill aside. We'll have a chance to discuss among ourselves informally the proposed amendments and come back tomorrow morning at 9:30. So it's now 10:34 a.m., and we're adjourned for the day.